I want to share two words with you this morning. The first is the word irony. What does it mean if something is ironic? If you could give me a definition, what would you tell me as far as irony? This is what I found on the computer. And, of course, irony can have several different meanings, I suppose, different shades of meaning. But this is the one that really I want to focus in on this morning. A state of affairs or an event that seems deliberately contrary to what one expects and is often amusing as a result. It sounds like a definition, doesn't it? It's a little bit wordy. A state of affairs or an event that seems deliberately contrary to what one expects and is often amusing as a result. Irony. The second word that I want to share with you is the word reversal. Reversal. And you could define reversal in this way: a change to an opposite direction, position, or course of action. Reversal. Let me share that definition with you one more time. A change to an opposite direction, position, or course of action. So irony and reversal. How often can we describe life in this world with these two words, irony and reversal? How many times does it appear that things are going one direction, and it seems assured that certainly this or that is going to happen because of the way things are going? But then all of a sudden, something very unexpected happens, and instead of the expected outcome, something far different happens. There's a complete 180 in what occurs. How often in life is there the reversal or something that is ironic? We think something's going to happen, but instead the exact opposite happens. Let's think about the world of sports for just a little while. I'm not a huge sports fan. Used to be when I was younger. I watched the Cubs games. Back in those days, the Cubs did not do very well at all. They started doing a little bit better not too long ago. I'm not sure how they're doing right now. But anyway, maybe you're a Cubs fan, maybe you're not. Maybe you are a Patriots fan, maybe you're not. Anyway, the world of sports, it's a big, wide world. And how many times, even if you're not a sports fan, you realize this to be the case, how many times do the underdogs pull off a big upset? How many times does that happen? The odds are against them, but still they win against the best team, at least the so-called best team. Not too long ago, there was what was called March Madness. And you would have the brackets that you could fill out. You know, who's going to win the championship? Who's going to win this whole March Madness thing? And every year, without fail, people are surprised because this low-ranked team beat the number one seed or the number two seed. And with that, maybe your whole bracket is thrown off, right? You understand how that works? Or let's focus on the sphere of world affairs for just a little bit. We realize that the battle or the war, the victory, does not always go to the strongest army or the most well-equipped army. It doesn't always turn out that way, does it? You open up the history books and you realize time after time after time, there are small armies that win significant victories over a much better, much more well-equipped army. How true are the words of Solomon that we read in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 11? Solomon says this: I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. It's a little while ago that I preached through the book of Ecclesiastes, and I believe that what Solomon says here is true. The race is not always to the swift. The battle is not always to the strong. And we have to understand what Solomon is saying here when he says, time and chance happeneth to them all. And we're not going to get into all the details of that. We recognize that what Solomon says is true in that there are things that we would call chance occurrences. And they happen all the time, don't they? You have the Olympics. And you have the person who is like the world's fastest runner. And you assume, well, that person is going to win the race, right? But it doesn't always work that way. The race is not always to the swift. We could give many more examples. So there is a very real sense. It is true what Solomon says. There are many things that happen by what we call chance. But yet also on the other side of things, we realize from the scriptures, beyond any doubt, that even the most quote-unquote chance of circumstances are not really chance, are they? God is in control of everything. So on the one hand, we can say things happen by chance. On the other hand, we can say nothing really happens by chance. But yet, both are true, depending on how we understand them, right? The scriptures are filled with truth about how men or women make plans, whether they're good plans or whether they're bad plans. And we've read about in the scriptures how those plans time and time again are frustrated. They aren't fulfilled. A man or a woman may do this or that, and they have this intention, this goal, this purpose. And sometimes their goal is met, sometimes their purpose is met, but other times they are kept from doing what they want to do. Especially the Bible talks about those who have wicked plans and how time after time their wicked plans are frustrated. They have these wicked intentions, they even take action to fulfill their wicked purposes, but then something quite the contrary occurs. Yes, they want to harm others, but many times, or at least sometimes, the result is that they themselves are hurt instead of them hurting others. Consider some passages with me this morning. In Psalm 7, we read this in verses 15 and 16. It says, "He made a pit and digged it, and has fallen into the ditch which he made. His mischief shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealings shall come down upon his own pate," or his own head. Two psalms later, in Psalm 9, we read this in verses 15 and 16. "The heathen are sunk down in the pit that they made. In the net which they hid is their own foot taken. The Lord is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands." Haggion, Selah. Again, in Psalm 57 and verse 6, the psalmist says, "They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit before me, into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves." And this is a common refrain in the scriptures. The wicked, they dig that metaphorical pit, and they are putting it right in your path. They set that metaphorical snare or trap, and they want to trap somebody in it, their enemy. But instead of them trapping someone in the pit or the snare, they themselves fall in the pit or they're trapped in the trap. In Proverbs 29, verses 5 and 6, we read this. "A man that flattereth his neighbor spreadeth a net for his feet. In the transgression of an evil man there is a snare, but the righteous doth sing and rejoice." Would you agree with the words that we just read? How true it is. The wicked, they have their evil schemes. They take action to fulfill those evil schemes. But we read in history time and time again, the wicked are ensnared by their own traps. This morning I invite you to turn with me in your Bibles to the book of Esther. We'll be considering Esther chapters 5 through 7 this morning. And remember those two words that we began with this morning? The word irony, the word reversal. And here in Esther, especially verses 5 through 7, we read about ironies and we read about reversals, and all of these are occurring according to God's plan. And even though as we read through chapter 5 and chapter 6 and chapter 7 of Esther, not once we read the name God, not once do we find a reference explicitly to prayer, and that's the case throughout the whole book of Esther, but yet we see clearly how God is at work. There's a wicked man in this passage, and this wicked man is digging what we'd call a metaphorical pit, but he himself is going to fall into that pit. Now, before we begin reading in chapter 5 of Esther, let me just refresh your memories concerning the context of Esther here. In the beginning of the book, chapters 1 and 2, we read about a very wealthy king. His name is King Ahasuerus. He is the king of the whole kingdom of Persia. His wife's name is Queen Vashti. Now, King Ahasuerus held a very great feast in the capital of Susa. And at those feasts, the prominent aspect of the feast was not so much eating food as it was drinking wine. And at the end of this long feast, The king was quite merry with the wine that he had drunk, no doubt, and he called for Vashti, the queen, to come and present herself before all the men of this great party. And the queen obstinately refused to come and do as the king had bidden. The king became very, very angry. And the king consulted with his advisors, and his advisors counseled him, put away the queen, replace her with someone who is much better. And the king heeded their advice. Vashti was banished from the king's presence. And after some time, the king began looking for a replacement queen. So he issued the command that beautiful young women would be brought from all over the empire. And from these beautiful young women, the king would choose for himself a new queen. And Esther is chosen as one of these beautiful young women. And Esther, along with the others, undergo a year-long beauty treatment. Her cousin Mordecai commanded her to keep her Jewish identity secret. Mordecai is not only her cousin, but also is basically her adopted father. And so Esther keeps her Jewish identity a secret. Now Esther is chosen as queen, and a feast is held in her honor. Mordecai holds an important governmental position in the gate of Susa. Now, while serving in that position of authority, Mordecai hears a report. He somehow finds out that there is a threat against the king's life. There are two eunuchs, and they had put together plans to assassinate the king. Well, Mordecai spreads that news to Esther, passes it along to Esther, and Esther reports to the king in Mordecai's name that there is a threat against the king's life. The king has it investigated. It's found out to be true, and these two eunuchs are put to death. So those first two chapters of Esther, we realize this world is far from perfect. This imperfect world is filled with imperfect people who make imperfect choices, but yet God is still at work. In this imperfect world, He uses imperfect people, even He uses their imperfect choices to fulfill His perfect plan. Well, we move on to chapters 3 and 4 of Esther, and we read about a very dark hour in the history of the Jewish people. The forces of evil were at work, and it seemed like wickedness had the upper hand. But even in this very darkest of hours in Jewish history, God is there. God was in control. His hand was at work. There was great reason for hope. The very beginning of Esther chapter 3, we're introduced to a man named Haman. Haman is promoted to the second highest position in the kingdom. Only the king is higher than he. And everybody is commanded to show obeisance to Haman. They're to bow down to Haman to show respect to him. But Mordecai, the Jew, refuses to bow down. He refuses to give Haman honor and respect. Now Haman determines to destroy all of Mordecai's people. It was too little a thing for Mordecai just to pay the price for his insubordination. No, the entire Jewish people, Mordecai's people, they must pay the price. They must be destroyed. So Haman casts Pur, that is the lot, in order to set the date for the Jewish people's destruction. And he presents this wicked plan before King Ahasuerus, and King Ahasuerus basically gives Haman a blank check. Do whatever you want. And a proclamation of the future date of the Jews' destruction is proclaimed far and wide through all the 127 provinces of the Persian Empire. Now Mordecai the Jew, he learns what has happened. He publicly shows his grief and his bitterness of soul. He puts on sackcloth and he puts ashes on his head. All the Jews of the empire respond likewise, at least most all of the Jews. But Queen Esther is in the palace and her identity is still hidden. And Queen Esther interacts with Mordecai, and Mordecai tells Queen Esther what has happened. He urges Esther, implore for us as Jews, implore for us before the king. Perhaps we will have deliverance. Now Esther protests. Esther is concerned about her own safety. But Mordecai expresses his conviction that deliverance will come to the Jews. Perhaps Esther has risen to her position of authority for such a time as this. Now Queen Esther, she eventually decides, yes, this is the best thing for me to do. I will go before the king, and if I die, I die. And Queen Esther orders Mordecai to gather all the Jews together, and they must fast for her. And she herself and all of her maidens will do likewise. They will fast. And at the end of the 3 days, she would appear before the king. If she dies, she dies. Now, Mordecai does as Esther commands. And it's in this context of all of the Jews gathering together to fast that we read in Esther chapter 5 in verses 1 through 4. Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner courts of the king's house, over against the king's house, and the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house, over against the gate of the house. And it was so when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. Then said the king unto her, What wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given to thee to the half of the kingdom. And Esther answered, If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him. Now, if you remember from the previous context, it was a well-known fact all throughout the Persian Empire that anyone who appeared before the king without his explicit invitation was risking death. The only way that a person could come uninvited before the king without dying was if the king extended his golden scepter. Now, it was for this very reason that Esther voiced her concern to Mordecai concerning coming before the king. Both Mordecai and all the Jews, everybody in the kingdom, realized if you came before the king uninvited, you are risking death. And Esther told Mordecai, I haven't even been called to come before the king for some 30 days. What's going on here? What would happen if I presented myself before the king without invitation? Now, Esther was rightfully concerned about her appearance before the king. But Esther did determine, this is what I will do. I will come before the king even though he hasn't called me. And she asked Mordecai to gather the Jews of Susa together so they could fast for her. And Esther herself and her maids would fast, and she would make her appearance before the king. So the third day of her fasting came, and Esther put on her royal apparel. She made her way to the king's house. And she stood there in the inner court, and that was a place where the king, as he sat on his throne, could see her. And for Esther, as she made her way and she was in that place, it seemed as if perhaps her life was out of her own hands. It was now up to King Ahasuerus whether she lived or whether she died. If the king extended the royal scepter, the golden scepter, then she would live. If he refused to extend the golden scepter, she'd be put to death. So you can imagine the relief of Queen Esther whenever King Ahasuerus extended his golden scepter. How thankful she would have been that she had obtained favor in his sight. The king was not offended. The king was not furious at her coming before him uninvited. No, the king was pleased to see her. Now, the king knew full well how dangerous a decision Esther had made, how she was risking her own life to come uninvited before his presence. He knew that something of the utmost importance caused her to come before him in that way. So whenever she came near and she touched his scepter, he asked her. She asked her what we would have asked her. What has brought you to me? What has made you make this decision that is so dangerous for you, it's even risking your life? The king went on to assure her, Whatever you ask, I will grant it, even to half the kingdom. Surely this was the opportunity Esther was waiting for. Surely this was the time that she should share with the king the danger for her own life and the danger of her whole people. They've been doomed to destruction. Surely this was the opportunity. Or was it the opportunity? We read the queen's response in verse 4. If it pleased the king, would the king and Haman come to a banquet that she had prepared? Well, the king was quite pleased, and he was glad to come to this banquet along with Haman. And so we read in the next verse, verse 5, Then the king said, Cause Haman to make haste, that he may do as Esther hath said. So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. We continue reading verse 6, And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, What is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed. Now we today have never been to a Persian feast. That happened centuries, even millennia before we were ever born. But it appears that a banquet such as what Esther held, there was what we call perhaps a banquet proper, where you'd have all the food that was eaten and probably wine that was drunk as well. But then after that banquet proper, there would be what was called the banquet of wine that would come afterwards, where there would be probably just relaxation, conversation, and the drinking of wine. So it appears that at this time, during this time of drinking of wine after the feast, that the king asked Esther once again, "What do you want? Even to the half of the kingdom, I'll give it to you." Now surely this was the opportunity for Esther, right? Surely this was the time that she could tell the king, "My life is in danger. The Jews, all my people, have been condemned to death, and it's Haman who has done this." Surely this was the opportunity she had been waiting for. Or was it? We continue reading in verse 7. "Then answered Esther and said, 'My petition and my request is...'" And it seems as if she cuts off her flow of thought there. She cuts her statement short. "My petition and my request is..." And if we saw this on a printed page, it might see dot, dot, dot. But then she doesn't say anything after that. She cuts her request short. But then she goes on to say in verse 8, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and I will do tomorrow as the king has said." So what is the petition and the request that Esther had? Why had she risked her life to come before the king uninvited? Was her petition and request to invite the king and Haman to the banquet the first time? That wasn't her main request, was it? Was her petition and request to invite the king and Haman to the second banquet? No, that's not the main request, is it? Esther basically cut her statement short. "My petition and my request is..." It's like she was having second thoughts. Is she worried about the whole scenario? Is she perhaps having failing courage now? What was she thinking? Was she afraid of how the king would respond to her request about revealing her own Jewishness and the danger for her life and the king taking action on behalf of her and the Jewish people? What's going on here? We don't know why she didn't tell the king her request at this time. We don't know if she was having a failure of courage or if it was God prompting her to not tell the king right away. But either way, Esther assured the king, "I have a banquet prepared for you tomorrow. And tomorrow at this banquet, I will share with you my petition and my request. Tomorrow when I share that with you, if it pleases the king, then you can perform my request. You can grant my petition." So we continue reading verses 9 and following. So we have the banquet now over. And tomorrow is when the king and Haman will come to a second banquet. So how are things going now after the banquet? Verse 9. "Then went Haman forth that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself, and when he came home, he sent and called for his friends and Zeresh his wife. And Haman told them of the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him, and how he advanced him above all the princes and the servants of the king. Haman said, moreover, 'Yea, Esther the queen did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared but myself. And tomorrow am I invited unto her also with the king. Yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate.'" So right after Haman and the king left the banquet, Haman was in the best of moods. You could say he was having a hilltop experience. He was happy, he was joyful, you know, everything was going his way. But it didn't take long before he was no longer joyful as can be. He was angry as can be. He was frustrated. Because as he left the queen's banquet, he passed by the king's gate, and there was Mordecai. And Mordecai didn't even so much as stand up to give him favor or respect. He didn't bow down before him, not by any means. Upon the sight of this one man, Mordecai, all the joy, all the good nature of Haman quickly evaporated into thin air. Instead of being in the best of spirits, Haman was enraged with the greatest of anger. It seems that Haman just couldn't allow the thought of Mordecai seeing him openly enraged and displeased because of Mordecai's disrespect. Haman couldn't go down to the level of just lashing out against him. It seemed that Haman did nothing to Mordecai in light of Mordecai's basically ignoring him, disrespecting him. So it seems that Haman just walked right by Mordecai, maybe looking straight ahead. But whenever he arrived home, we have Haman, and he gathers his friends to him and his wife, Zeresh. And what does Haman do? He relates to his wife and his friends how much money he had. I'm as rich as can be. I have all this money, and I have so many children, too. Later on, we realize Haman has 10 sons. That's not even counting daughters. So he tells them, I have so many children, and I have such a high position that the king has promoted me to. And I'm the only one that was invited to this great banquet with the king. Queen Esther invited me, the only one besides the king. And tomorrow, Haman told the friends and his wife, tomorrow Esther has invited me also and just the king as well. So in short, what was Haman doing? He was bragging about how great of a life he had and how great of a person he was. But after saying all these pompous words, it seems like he just broke down and he confessed the truth that all of this matters nothing so long as Mordecai is there in the king's gate. Haman basically was saying, my life is wretched because of this insubordinate and disrespectful Jew. That's the essence of what Haman was saying. Well, no doubt this was no surprise to Haman's wife, to the friends that were gathered around. I'm imagining the animosity between Haman and Mordecai was quite apparent to everybody. So, Zeresh, Haman's wife, and all of his friends, they wanted to help Haman out. He was having a hard time with all of this. And so they give him some advice. And that advice is in verse 14 here. Then said Zeresh's wife and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made of 50 cubits high, and tomorrow speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. Then go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. A gallows should be built. Now, in all likelihood, what was recommended by the wife of Haman and his friends was not what we'd envision. When we envision a gallows, what do we envision? We envision a platform of sorts, and there are nooses, right? Nooses hanging from those gallows. That's what we envision. In all likelihood, what Zeresh and his friends encouraged Haman to build was what we call a pike or a stake. And the intention of this was to impale people, okay? Not a pleasant thought, but that no doubt is what was going on here. And so, it's not just in the ordinary pike, though. Not an ordinary gallows. It's to be 50 cubits high. Do you realize how high that would be? If we had transfer that to our modern measurements, it'd be somewhere around 75 to 85 feet. That's a very monstrous construction. But that's the whole goal here. Mordecai is so wretched of a man. He needs to be killed, and his dead body needs to be displayed so everybody can see it. So, here's the advice, and Haman was pleased to accept that advice. See, Haman's wife and his friends didn't want Haman's time at the banquet the next day to be spoiled. So, take care of Mordecai, and then he can go on and you can have a good time at the party. So, Haman gave the command, build the structure, put the pike up, build it 85 feet tall. So, it's in this context that we come to chapter 6 of Esther. And it's in chapter 6 that we have the beginning of irony and reversal really coming to the forefront here. We realize that the events in chapter 6, just like the events of all the book of Esther, these are not just chance occurrences. No, there's no such thing as a chance occurrence in God's plan. Not in the way that we're looking at that word chance. God is in control. So Esther chapter 6 now, verses 1 through 3. On that night could not the king sleep. And he commanded to bring the book of records of the chronicles and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this?" Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, "There is nothing done for him." Let me ask you today, have you ever had a sleepless night? Have you ever had a sleepless night? If we are old at all, and I'm not saying that any of you are old, but if we have lived very long at all of us have had sleepless nights, right? I've had sleepless nights. You've had sleepless nights. What do you do on sleepless nights? How do you try to get back to sleep? Or if there's no hope of getting back to sleep, how do you occupy yourself? Do you just lay there and have your eyes closed and try to go to sleep? Or what do? Well, just like everybody has sleepless nights, here we read that King Ahasuerus just simply could not get to sleep. You know, was it something he ate? Probably not. Maybe it was. Was it because he had something on his mind? Is he wondering, what is it that Queen Esther wants to ask me? Is that what was on his mind? What? We don't know for sure. But the very night after this great banquet where Esther and the king and Haman were present, on that very night after Haman had given the command to build the gallows or the pike so that Mordecai could be impaled on it, it was on that very night that the king simply could not go to sleep. Now, you hear the solution of how to get back to sleep. You count sheep, right? Was the king counting sheep? Probably not. How would the king go to sleep, or how would he occupy himself during this sleepless night? Well, he called for his servants to come, and he called for the chronicles of the kingdom to be brought. Okay, so this would be a listing of all the significant things that had happened in the kingdom. And he called for these chronicles to be brought and to be read to him. Now, was the intention that as the chronicles were read, he'd grow sleepy and he'd fall asleep? Now, one commentator has likened it to listening to the record of all the legislation in Congress, you know, and what goes on in Congress. You know, have that read to you on a sleepless night. How long would it take for you to get tired and fall asleep? Was that the king's rationale? Or was he really searching for an answer to something that was on his mind? Or was there something else? Was it just because he wanted to pass the time on the sleepless night? We don't know for sure. But whatever the exact reason, as those chronicles were read, there was an oversight that was uncovered. There was something that came to the king's attention that he hadn't realized before. Because as these chronicles were read, the event concerning Mordecai came to the king's attention. How Mordecai had told concerning an assassination plot on the king's life. How there were two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthana and Teresh, that had planned on assassinating the king, and Mordecai had revealed the plot. It was investigated. The two men, Bigthana and Teresh, were put to death. And the king was wondering, has Mordecai been rewarded for his act of service? It was common for Persian kings to go out of their way to honor those who did something exemplary in the kingdom. So the king is wondering, what has been done for Mordecai? And the king's servants answer, well, nothing has been done for Mordecai. Well, that can't be. Really, that would make things look poorly for the king. To not do something in honor of somebody who had saved your life, that would give a poor report for the king. So naturally, here the king is wondering, well, what's been done for Mordecai? And if nothing has been done, well, something needs to be done then. So throughout this narrative of the book of Esther, we realize the king doesn't like to make decisions on his own. So what is he going to do for Mordecai? He's not going to come up with the idea on his own. He's going to ask somebody else for advice. So he's wondering, well, who is out in the king's court that I can ask about how to honor Mordecai? Well, we read in verses 4 and 5, the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman was coming to the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said unto him, behold, Haman standeth in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So at that very moment, when the king is wanting advice as to how to honor Mordecai, and he's wanting some advice, who is in the king's court except for Haman? Is that coincidence? Is that just a chance occurrence? We realize it's not. So Haman is in the king's court. And Haman had come for what purpose? He had come to ask the king for permission to impale Mordecai's body on that stake, on that 75, 80-foot-high stake. So the king found out that Haman was in the court, and the king instructed for Haman to be brought before him. Maybe the king was still in bed at this time. We don't know for sure. Now, neither the king nor Haman realized what was on the other's mind. Little did they know that the king and Haman, little did they know that the other had an opposite plan of action, right? Had opposite thoughts. Now, is this occurring in the middle of the night? Maybe. Or is it occurring on the following morning? Had the king been listening to the Chronicles all night, and now it's morning? Possibly. We don't know, but what we do know is that Haman is now coming before the king. And this is not a chance occurrence. This is the hand of God at work. So verses 6 and following. So Haman came in, and the king said unto him, "What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "To whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself?" And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the royal crown which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor." Is this a chance occurrence? Not by any means. So the king in a sleepless night had just found out that Mordecai had saved his life, or at least he had done something to preserve the king's life, and nothing had been done to honor Mordecai. The king wants to ask somebody as far as, how should we honor Mordecai? And who better to ask that question of than his trusted advisor, Haman? So Haman comes in, and the king asks him so much, only he asks in general terms. He never mentions Mordecai's name. What should be done for the man whom the king wants to honor? Now, as we know, Haman is a man who thinks a little bit highly of himself, right? Or maybe a lot highly of himself. And in Haman's mind, as the king asks that question, what should be done to the man whom the king wishes to honor? Who is the one that the king wishes to honor? Well, in Haman's mind, who better would the king want to honor than me, myself? So he's thinking in his mind, what should be done for the man whom the king wants to honor? He's thinking of himself, I have plenty of money. I don't need money. I have basically everything that I need except maybe this is what can be done. Maybe I can be king for a day, so to speak. So Haman says, as he thinks about what should be done for the man whom the king wants to honor, I have plenty of money. I'm in the second highest position in the kingdom. What can be done? Haman craved honor and respect. He wanted everybody to have him in high esteem. So Haman thought, what better honor than if I could wear the king's own clothes? Keeping in mind, these were not just ordinary clothes. These probably were decked out in gold and rubies and the king's own clothes. And what better than to ride the king's own horse? And as we read the text, we might think that Haman wants to wear the king's own crown, but it's actually a crown or a diadem placed on the horse's head. Okay? So Haman is thinking, I want to wear the king's clothes, I want to ride on the king's horse, and on the horse's head is a certain royal diadem or crown. And then let one of the king's most noble princes lead me around on the horse and proclaim, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king wants to honor. Throughout this whole process, Haman is thinking, I'm that man the king wants to honor. He was positive of that, no doubt in his mind. But how shocked he must have been whenever we read the words of verse 10. Then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. Can you imagine Haman's response? How appalled, how horrified he would have been done, how he would have been horrified at that. We can say amen to that, right? But how horrified he was. Of all those honors that he had envisioned coming on himself, he is the one that had to honor Mordecai in that way. How horrified he must have been whenever the king told him, you are the honored, the noble prince that has to lead Mordecai around. You have to dress him in my clothing. You have to put him on my horse. You have to lead him around the city square and proclaim loud and clear, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king wishes to honor. So Haman was appalled. He was horrified, no doubt. But there was no way to get out of the king's command. We can only imagine what was going on in Haman's mind, what Mordecai thought, as Haman led him on the king's horse, proclaiming throughout the city square, thus shall it be done for the man whom the king wishes to honor. So verses 11 and 12, then took Haman the apparel and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and brought him on horseback through the street of the city and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor. And Mordecai came again to the king's gate, but Haman hasted to his own house mourning and having his head covered. So we read nothing about how Mordecai responded through this whole scenario. But we do read about Haman's response. He obediently fulfilled the king's command. But then what did he do? He ran back to his house with his head covered. And it says that he was mourning. Now, normally that behavior is the behavior of somebody who is mourning somebody who has died, right? But here Haman is so grieved, he's so sad, that he has his head covered and he's mourning because he had to honor his arch enemy, Mordecai. This one that he wanted to have impaled, he now had to lead around in the courtyard or in the city square and proclaiming that he is honored. So Haman must have been feeling terrible. He was completely humiliated. It was bad for Haman as if somebody had died. So now he's back at home. He gathers his wife and his friends. Only this time there's no boasting. We read instead in verse 13. And Haman told Zeresh his wife and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Zeresh his wife unto him, if Mordecai be of the seed of the Jews, before whom thou hast begun to fall, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him. So those same people, at least the wife, now whether the friends are here called as wise men, there's some debate about that. But here, at least the wife who had said, build this pike and have Mordecai impaled on it, hung on that. Now the same person and Haman's wise men are saying, if this has happened to you, and Mordecai the Jew, if he's been honored and you've been humbled before him, if this is the case, then there's no way you're going to have victory over the Jewish people. You have begun to fall, and you will surely fall before him. And specifically, it's talking about you're falling before Mordecai. You're not going to have the victory over Mordecai. You're not going to have victory over the Jews either. We realize that. So there's no hope of victory. Do you see the irony in these verses? How it seemed like everything was coming to this end, but then all of a sudden, the exact opposite happens. Everything's been turned upside down. There have been extreme reversals, and there are more reversals to come. But has the irony come to pass? Have the reversals come to pass just because of chance? In a way, it seems like it's all just happenstance, right? That's just how things happened. We understand God is at work through all of these events. His hand is there. God is at work. So God is the one who is bringing the evil plans and the evil actions of wicked Haman upon his own head. Haman has dug the pit, and he is hoping that he can catch Mordecai in that pit. But what happens instead? Haman is going to fall headlong into that pit. So no sooner had Haman been talking with his wife and his friends and his wise men, and they told him what's going to happen as far as his fall. No sooner had that happened, and even as they were still talking, who comes for him? The king's eunuchs. To bring him off to the king's banquet, or the queen's banquet. And so we read in verse 14, and while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared. So we come to chapter 7. So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed, even to the half of the kingdom. Here's King Ahasuerus, and Haman gathered together with Queen Esther. Remember, the banquet is focusing not so much on the food, but on the wine. And now as they're enjoying the wine after the feast, the king once again, for the third time, asks Esther, "What is your request? I will give it to you up to half my kingdom." Now, on the previous two occasions, Esther has not revealed her request, but now the time has come. Verses 3 and 4. Then Esther the queen answered and said, "If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage." So what is the queen's request? It wasn't for money. It wasn't for any other sort of possession or wealth. Her petition was for her own life. Her request was for the life of her people, the Jewish people. She and her people had been sold to death, to destruction. And Esther uses the words here, "We have been sold to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish," using the very words of the prior proclamation issued by Haman. They had been sold. Now, sadly, they had been sold so that they could be utterly destroyed. Now, if it had been just merely a matter of them being sold into slavery, Esther said she would have kept quiet. She wouldn't even brought this matter before the king. She would have viewed it as something not worthy of his attention. But as it was, the Jews' destruction, Esther says, the Jews' destruction would bring incomparable loss to the king. Just thinking monetarily, yes, Haman had promised a vast amount of silver, a vast amount of money for the permission to destroy the Jews. But even thinking monetarily, if all the Jews would have been sold into slavery, the king would have received much more money than what Haman had promised. But this idea of all the Jews being destroyed, Esther says, you couldn't counteract the loss that you will suffer because of the loss of the Jews. So the king had absolutely no idea what Esther was going to request. He was what we'd call blindsided, completely taken off guard. Understandably, he wanted to know, who could do such a thing? Who is threatening your life? Who wants to kill you? Who wants to kill your people? And so we read verse 5. King Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, "Who is he? Where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so?" And the queen's answer, verse 6, Esther said, "The adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman." Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. You see how the tables have turned. The one who previously had come before the king and had gained approval to destroy all the Jews, this one who was named Haman, this one who had undoubtedly instilled fear in the masses of the Jews by his deadly edict, this one Haman is now afraid in the presence of, yes, the king and the queen who is a Jew. So the uncertainty that had overshadowed the Jewish people is now overshadowing Haman himself. Haman had been revealed as the wicked enemy of the Jews, the wicked enemy of the queen herself. His wickedness had been exposed. And so with such a revelation, how is the king going to respond? How would things play out? We aren't left hanging because we continue reading verses 7 and 8. "And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Then said the king, 'Will he force the queen also before me in the house?' As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face." You can imagine how angry King Ahasuerus would have been. Here is a man who wants to murder his queen. And the one who wants to murder her is none other than Haman, who is sitting with him at that banquet. Now, perhaps you have gotten angry before. I think all of us have gotten angry. But how do we respond to our anger? We respond in different ways. But are there ever instances in your life, whether in the past or in the current time, whether whenever you get angry, is there ever a time when you get so angry you just have to leave? You know, you have to get away from everything. And I think that's what's going on here with King Ahasuerus. He's so angry, he gets up and he goes out of the place where they're eating and drinking, and he goes out to the garden. Haman is left behind with the queen. Haman realizes his life is in danger. The king does not intend good things for him. And so what does Haman do? He gets down on his knees and begs for his life before Queen Esther. Keep in mind, Queen Esther here is reclining upon a couch. In the King James, it says a bed, but it's the idea of a couch. And remember, the Persian Empire was so wealthy, they had couches of gold and silver. So here's Queen Esther reclining on a golden couch, no doubt. That's how they would eat and drink in those days. So Queen Esther, in her position as she probably had been during the whole period of the feast, the banquet, and here is Haman bowing down before her, begging for his life, begging for mercy. And it's upon this scene that the king returns. And now, what does the king say? He says to Haman, "Are you going to force the queen as well in my presence, in the very house where I am? Will Haman be so bold as to assault the queen? Is it not enough that Haman wants to murder her, that he's now going to assault her?" Now, no sooner had the word come from the king's mouth that Haman was seized, his head was covered, and then one of the eunuchs of the king's gave this advice, verses 9 and 10. "And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, 'Behold also the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman.' Then the king said, 'Hang him thereon.' So they hanged Haman on the gallows that had been prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified." So the very gallows or the pike that Haman had built for Mordecai so that he could be impaled on it, that very pike was used for Haman. The disgrace that Haman wished upon Mordecai, that disgrace fell upon Haman. Haman would pay for his wickedness. Mordecai, the one who had been loyal to the king, the one who had gone out of his way to ensure the king's safety, Mordecai would be raised to a position of prominence. In fact, as we read later on, Mordecai would take Haman's place, his place of position of authority. So the events of chapter 5 through 7 of Esther, all of those things happened by chance, right? Just pure happenstance, all of these things happened. Now, it may seem like it's a series of coincidences, things that happened good for Mordecai and Esther, things that happened bad for Haman. We know it's not just a series of fortunate consequences for Mordecai and Esther. No, it's not just mere coincidence. God's perfect plan was at work. God's hand was involved in all of this. We could say that God is the author of all of this thick irony and all the dramatic reversals of this account. Haman, sometime before, had wickedly gained the king's approval to have all the Jews destroyed. Haman had built a gallows or a pike with the intent of executing Mordecai and displaying his body and exposing it to great shame. Haman was a man who was obsessed with his own greatness. Haman craved recognition. He demanded honor and respect. He was incensed whenever Mordecai refused to bow down before him, whenever Mordecai didn't give him honor and respect. Nothing made him more angry than seeing Mordecai disrespect him. So it seemed that Haman and his wicked plans and his actions were going to definitely destroy Mordecai and the Jews. It seemed that everybody would honor him except for those that Haman destroyed or killed. But yet how the tables were turned. Things turned out far differently than one might expect. So Haman wanted to be honored on the one hand, and he wanted the one man who refused to honor him to be destroyed. But instead of receiving honor, Haman gave honor to whom? To Mordecai. Haman gave honor to the man that he despised. Haman is the one that proclaimed concerning Mordecai, "Thus shall do the king do to the man, or thus shall it be done to the man whom the king wishes to honor." So Haman had built the pike for Mordecai. Little did he know that he would be the one hanging on that pike and not Mordecai. See the great reversal? So Haman was incensed that there was one Jew, Mordecai, that would not bow down to him and show him respect. What happens in the end? Haman is bowing down and begging for his life before a Jew, Esther the queen. You see the reversal? The tables were turned. How true are the words of Solomon as we read in the book of Proverbs? Proverbs 18 and verse 12. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty, and before honor is humility. Haman was so haughty and proud, but that led to his destruction, didn't it? Proverbs 16 and verse 18. Pride goeth before destruction, and in haughty spirit before a fall. That describes Haman so very well. Haman was so haughty, the most proud, but in the end, Haman was destroyed. He fell before the people that he sought to destroy. So think about Haman. Think about him digging a pit to catch Mordecai and the Jewish people. Haman dug that pit. He had laid a snare for the Jewish people. But that pit that he dug, the snare that he laid, were the very means of his own destruction. The words of the psalmist are so very true, as we read earlier in Psalm 9, verses 15 and 16. The heathen are sunk down in the pit that they made, and the net which they hid is their own foot taken. The Lord is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands. Those verses of the psalmist play out in the life of Haman and all that we read in Esther chapter 5, 6, and 7. All throughout Esther, we see that God is a God who is in control. So not once is the name God mentioned. Not once do we read explicit mention of prayer. But all throughout Esther, we see God's hand at work. God is in control. He's on the throne. So God is the one that decrees who's a winner and who's a loser. God is the one who gives life. He's the one who strikes down. He makes the decision. This is the one who dies. God is the one who guides the future, even as he has guided the past. And it may seem, back in Haman's day, even in our day today, it may seem as if the wicked plans and the wicked actions of people and nations are winning the day. There, it seems like the wickedness is prevailing, but yet we need to remind ourselves God is in control, the tables will turn, and maybe they won't turn as we expect them to, but eventually the tables will turn, won't they? God is in control. God is able to turn things upside down. And the greatest of ironies and the most dramatic of reversals are brought about by God himself. So this is the God that we know. This is the God that we love and serve. If nothing else from this passage in Esther, we need to stand in awe of our great God. Our God is a God who uses imperfect people and imperfect choices, imperfect circumstances. Our God is a God who even works through the most despicable of actions. God is a God who has his hand involved, and God does his will. And sometimes he does the most incredible of things. It seems like things are going one way, but then he turns it completely around. This is the God that we know. This is the God that we love and serve. And so may we stand in awe of this God. May we worship this God. May we trust him today. God fulfills his perfect plan. So I hope that you know Jesus as your Savior today, because God has provided salvation for all of us through Jesus. Jesus is God's Son. Jesus is God in the flesh. And God has provided salvation for us through Jesus. And so we read about God, the God of Esther. It's the same God that we serve today through Jesus Christ our Lord. So do you know God? Have you accepted Jesus as your Savior? That's the most important decision you can ever make. If you have trusted Jesus, know that the God of Esther is the God that we serve. And God is at work in today's world just as he was in Esther's world. May we trust him. May we serve him. May we tell others about God's greatness. He is the one in control. So today, as you turn on the news, you see all the things going on in our country, it may seem as if the wicked plans of wicked people are having the upper hand. And we wonder, how is all this going to end? We don't know the answer how it's going to end a week from now, or how it's all going to turn out a week from now, or a month from now, or a year from now. But we know God is in control, and in the end, he wins the victory. Are you on God's side? If you are, let's worship him. Let's give him the glory. If you don't know God, if you're not on his side, come to his side today by trusting in Jesus. The incredible account of Esther chapter 5, 6, and 7. The story is not over yet. God still has much more to do.